Good morning. This is the Committee on Veterans Affairs, and I welcome all of you here. And notice I didn't say y'all today. That was good. And today is Tuesday, February the 8th, 2005, and welcome. As is our custom, we'd like to invite the veterans to stand at this time or raise your hand, and we'd like to recognize you because we're most grateful for your valor, your character, your dedication to the freedom of our country. Please stand or raise your hand.
Here.
Thank you so much. We do know that freedom isn't and wasn't free. And I would just like to compliment our Oregon National Guard, General Burns here, and Colonel Caldwell for the ceremony at Clackamas on Friday, or Saturday. It was beautifully orchestrated, and it certainly made you proud of our highly trained guardsmen and women. And it's a beautiful ceremony, and thank you for including us in that event. This was the 3670th, preparing to go to Iraq and probably be there a year. All right, this morning I want to open a hearing on House Bill 2133. And Mr. Administrator, would you please advise us of the contents of this bill?
Yes, Madam Chair and members, House Bill 2133 extends to members of organized militias of other states the reemployment rights of members of organized militias called into active state service in Oregon. It also declares an emergency as effective upon passage.
Yes. Okay, I'd like to ask Colonel Caldwell to come forward and comment. Oh, General Byrne also. Thank you on this House Bill 2133. Brought to us by the Oregon Military Department.
Madam Chairman and members of the committee, for the record, I am Brigadier General Raymond Byrne, Acting Adjutant General for the Oregon National Guard, with my Deputy Director, Colonel Mike Caldwell. House Bill 2133 was introduced by Governor Kulongoski at our request to ensure that a member of another National Guard who is employed in the state of Oregon is called to active duty by the representative respective governor of that other state is granted a leave of absence by the Oregon employer. The state of Washington passed a similar law in their 2001 session to protect Washingtonians who were called to state active duty in the Oregon National Guard, but who worked in and were residents of Washington. Unfortunately, we did not have adequate time to produce the same legislation for our 2001 session, so we asked the governor to pre-file this bill. I do not expect that we will see this provision used a great deal, but some employment situations will require this act to ensure that guardsmen are not punished for belonging to the National Guard of another state. I would ask for your passage, and I will answer any questions you may have.
Thank you, General Byrne. Are there questions of the General? Representative Byrne.
Thank you, Madam Chair. General, I'm just curious why this, if we missed 2001, why it wasn't done in 2003. Do you know any of the history with that?
Mike. Mr. Chairman, Representative Byrne, we may have miswritten that.
Oh, okay.
It was either
2003.
Yeah, I think it was 2003, so we can't correct it.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
No.
If not, I will close the hearing on House Bill 2133, and thank you, General Byrne and Colonel Caldwell. Is there anyone else who would like to speak on this bill? Okay. Thank you. I'm getting used to this gavel, yes. We will now open a work session on House Bill 2133. Do we have a motion?
So moved.
How do we state that?
Have a motion to accept the House bill as presented.
Representative Cobb moves House Bill 2133 to the floor, and would that be with a due pass recommendation?
Yes, with a due pass recommendation.
With a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? If not, I'll ask Aaron, our committee staff, to please call the roll.
Representative Boquist.
Excused.
Representative Cobb.
Excuse.
Representative Bruin.
Aye.
Representative Farr.
Aye.
Representative Hunt.
Absent.
Representative Kong.
Aye.
Chair Nelson.
Aye. The vote is unanimous and the motion passes. I will now close the work session on House Bill 2133.
Do you want a carrier or do you want to put it on the consent calendar?
I suggest we put it on the consent calendar. Would you agree, members? Okay. Could I have a motion, Representative Farr?
I make a motion that we place House Bill 2133 on the consent calendar.
Is there any discussion? If not, House Bill 2133 will be placed on the consent calendar. Thank you. I will now open the hearing on House Bill 2192.
Madam Chair, House Bill 2192 exempts state employers from continuing health coverage for employees who are on military leave if the employee's leave is with the Active Guard Reserve program.
Yeah, okay.
Okay, General Byrne and Colonel Caldwell are still here, which is good. Would you have comment on this bill?
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, again, I am Brigadier General Raymond Byrne, Acting Adjutant General for the Oregon National Guard. With me is my Deputy Director, Colonel Mike Caldwell. House Bill 2192 was pre-session filed by the Governor Kulongoski at our request. House Bill 2192 clarifies language in ORS 408.240 that was made law during the 2003 legislative session. The legislature determined in some cases when state employees were called up for federal active duty that the transition to the federal TRICARE health insurance, HMO, placed severe hardships on some families. In one case, a dependent child was receiving very specialized care from an Oregon provider, but once the Guardsman was called to active federal duty, it took several months to convince TRICARE to allow the charges for that specialized care. This placed a tremendous burden on the family at a time when their breadwinner was deployed to a combat zone in Iraq. The legislature recognized this problem and allowed any state employee to remain on state insurance for at least 1 year, giving time to work the bureaucracy of the federal system. What we are asking for today is that we amend the law so we do not place an undue burden on state agency when one of their employee elects to compete for a full-time position within the National Guard or Reserves. Presently, the way the law is written, we could encumber a state agency when a traditional drilling soldier or airman voluntarily seeks a position within the Guard and Reserve and is stationed at home. The key to this change is that when a person competes for an Active Guard Reserve, AGR, position, they are placed on federal active duty status under USC Title 32, which means that they are under the control of the governor, but their pay and entitlements are exactly what they would receive if they were on federal active duty anywhere in the armed forces. When a soldier or airman is called to federal active duty involuntarily, they fall under USC Title 10 or under the control of the president. This change will distinguish in state law from those two federal designations and not cause undue expenditure of state monies for a person who sought this type of employment. I would ask for your passage, and I will answer any questions you may have.
Thank you, General. Are there any questions?
Madam Chair.
Representative Kong.
In the first paragraph, sir, it says that for at least 1 year that we give them time to work with the bureaucracy. Is that enough? I'm sorry.
Good point.
That's a good question, Representative Comp. Under federal law, mobilizations occur up to 2 years.
Right.
Just a second, please. Mike, do you think we may want to extend that up to 2 years with 2 year deployments? Well, I would recommend we extend that up to 2 years because there's a federal law, there's a 24-month time period when they can be mobilized.
Right, because that was my concern when I've heard from Representative Boquist, and the uncertainty of when they're going to get back to the United States is always a variable that we're concerned about.
That would allow us flexibility.
Okay, thank you.
Good question, Representative Comp, and for the audience and our committee, we're happy to have Representative Barnhart to appear, but you realize he has no voice, which is wonderful.
I mean, we will really miss that, and we're very sorry about that.
Okay, any other questions? Then, in this case, I will now close the hearing on House Bill. Oh, excuse me. I'm gonna take it. Is there anyone else who would like to speak on this bill? Okay. I will now close the hearing on House Bill 2192, and I will now open a work session on House Bill 2192. And Representative Comp and members of the committee, I might explain that the chair is very receptive to your excellent concept that this bill should be amended. We can pass it with a proposed amendment that would occur before it moves on to the House. Would you like to make that motion, Representative Call?
Madam Chair, if you please. I'd like to move that we accept House Bill 2192 with the amendment that that we work with 2 years of giving time for people to work with the federal system. And I think, did I say it backwards? Oh, okay.
Okay. Madam Chair, what we will do as staff is we'll order that amendment and come back and have another work session
on
the bill with that amendment. And that way you won't be dealing with a conceptual amendment. We'll have legislative council draft it up and
bring it back.
Adopt it officially.
Well, then I take back my motion then.
We have to get the amendment.
What you might want to do is move that the bill be amended in the fashion that you like, and then we'll just stop. We would just stop there.
Okay.
For 24 months.
Okay. Well, Jim, do you want to say that for me?
No, ma'am.
I will.
Thank you.
Representative Comp has removed a motion that we pass House Bill 2192 with the proposed amendment, and I'll now entertain your motion that we amend this bill as you suggested.
Yes. I move that we amend House Bill 2192 with the clause that we want to give people at least 2 years to work within the federal system.
Thank you. Is there any discussion? Will the committee staff call the roll?
Representative Brown.
Aye.
Representative Carr.
Aye.
Representative Hunt.
Absent.
Representative Kong.
Aye.
Representative Boquist.
Excuse?
Representative
Burkhardt. Aye. For him. Aye. Okay, the motion is passed, and I'll now close the work session on House Bill 2192. And good work, committee, and we're on our way. I might mention at this time that tomorrow in House session, we'll be hearing our first bill that we passed a couple weeks ago, and this relates to the joint custody of children, the rule that that may not be changed by law if they're called up to active duty. So we'll look for fortunate happenings in the House tomorrow. All right, I'm just happy now to open an informational meeting, and I would like to invite the General and Colonel Caldwell, and I'm sorry, I'll need the name of this other individual who's sitting with you.
Madam Chairman, this is Carl Jorgensen. Carl is our the comptroller for the Oregon Military Department.
Thank you very much.
I guess Director of Financial Affairs is the actual title, right, Carl?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Thank you. Good morning, and please proceed and just identify yourself when you speak.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm Brigadier General Raymond Byrne, Acting Adjutant General for Oregon. With me today are Colonel Mike Caldwell, our Deputy Director, and Carl Jorgensen, our Director of Financial Administration.
Okay.
If during this brief at any time you wish to ask questions, please stop me and we'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you.
We have been invited here to present a brief overview of the Oregon Military Department's current budget request and information related to our agency's current budget and previous biennial budgets. The military department owns and operates facilities throughout Oregon, as indicated by this map. Our facilities can be broken down into two general categories of Army National Guard facilities and Air Guard facilities. Army National Guard facilities are indicated in red and green on this chart and are located throughout Oregon. Air National Guard facilities are indicated in blue on this chart. The Guard is a community-based organization. We feel it is part of our responsibilities as citizen soldiers and airmen to be an integral part of the communities where we are located. If you look at the map, you will see that to the north we have Camp Rialia Armed Forces Training Center located near Astoria. Camp Rialia is one of our major training areas and also houses our Air National Guard Radar Control Unit. In the northern Willamette Valley, we have the Portland Air National Guard Base, which houses an F-15 air defense fighter wing, two communication squadrons, a weather flight, and provides facilities for one of our Starbase youth programs. Camp Withicum, located in Clackamas, is the primary logistics facility for the Oregon National Guard. Armories in the region provide facilities for training traditional Guard members as well as serving as community centers for local non-military functions. The rental of our armories generate the majority of our other funds' revenues. In the central Willamette Valley, we have our Joint Force Headquarters, an Army aviation facility, several maintenance armory shops, armories, and the Camp Adair training facilities, which we have a license for use from the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. In southern Oregon, we have Kingsley Field, which trains F-15 fighter pilots and flight surgeons from throughout the United States. Kingsley Field also has an air control squadron and provides facilities for one of our Starbase youth programs. As you can see, we also have several armories in the southern portion of the state. To the east, we have armories in most major cities, an aviation facility in Pendleton, and training facilities in Redmond and Umatilla. Our Youth Challenge program is located near Bend in a former Department of Defense facility. The Oregon National Guard federal-state partnership provides many benefits for Oregonians. Overall, the federal government provides 94% of the funding of the Oregon National Guard. This equates to approximately $419 million per biennium, most of which is not reflected in our annual agency our biennial agency budget. Of the remaining 6% of our budget, 4% is provided by the general fund, and 2% is provided by the other fund revenue generated by our agency. Oregon's 4% general fund share of our total budget is primarily used to operate and maintain our 39 armories located throughout Oregon and provide minimum matching funds for the maintenance and repair of our Army logistics facilities and Air Guard bases. The majority of the funding to construct and maintain our other facilities is provided by the federal government. 10 years ago, we were at an all-time low in general fund support for personnel and facilities maintenance. It was not until the end of the 1990s where we started to recover. The damage, though, had been done. Our statewide facilities started a gradual and significant degradation in basic funding for repair and maintenance, from which we still have not recovered. Maintaining an adequate other funds balance is vital to the military department in meeting payroll requirements in all our budgetary program areas, responding to unanticipated catastrophic failures within our facilities and information systems, leveraging substantial federal participation, operating our Youth Challenge program, and our ability to respond to emergencies affecting our state.
Excuse me.
Yes.
Please, General Byrne, is the number of members of the Oregon Military Department, is that number set by some statute that we will have so many members?
Both the Air National Guard and the Army National Guard are based upon a force structure allocation that is determined by the Army and the Air Force, and then that's done congressionally with the force structure level.
So if I could please, General Burton, my concern is according to the chart that Carl just showed us, where you receive few funds in the 90s, was the enrollment the same in that period as it is today?
It is. It was.
Actually, it was higher. We had a little more force structure from the federal government. Madam Chairman, Colonel Caldwell, for the record. We had a little bit more force structure in the 90s, and that decreased somewhat in the latter part of the 90s. We started out, I think, in 1991, 92. We had around 6,700 authorized for the Army, and we had 2,100 authorized for the Air National Guard. Now today we're at 6,100 authorized and 2,200, right? 61?
Actually, it's 7,000. Okay. That's our force allocation is 7,000.
So it varies, but it stayed within that margin within 400 or 500 slots.
Within 400 or 500 is correct.
Right.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Oh, excuse me, just one other question, if I could, please. General Burton, or Carl, when we talk about budget, is it possible, I know the military would probably be unusual to be able to show the overhead. I know the Lottery Commission does. And would it be possible for you to let us know what portion of the budget is dedicated to administrative services?
Yes, Madam Chair, Carl Jorgensen, members of the committee. In this one chart, for example, you'll see a 20% part of the other fund. This is a centralized personnel plan to where our administrative offices, both in personnel and financial administration, do charge our federally supported programs for that central administration piece.
Oh, okay. Thank you very much. Any other questions at this time? Please proceed.
Another fund ending balance is critical for the operation of the following biennium. This is because rental revenues do not accumulate in sufficient amounts to pay required costs at the beginning of each biennium. We estimate a 3-month reserve is sufficient to fund other funds costs during that time period. Our other sources of other funds are derived from direct cost reimbursements from federally supported programs operated under our state and federal agreements for central administration and state government services. Rental arrangements for our facilities, disposal of surplus property, and sales of real property. Also, certificates of participation for supporting our major construction projects. And finally, Homeland Security grants to support security enhancements at the Anderson Readiness Center, housing the state's emergency operations agencies. And average daily membership revenue at our Youth Challenge program through an agreement with the Bend-Lapine School District. Over the past decade and a half, our state and federal cooperative agreements rose from 3 to the current arrangement of 16 agreements. These are agreements I referred to previously that produce a 7-to-1 return of federal dollars in our general fund match. These agreements requirements to create state jobs and procurement activities. To manage the increased financial accounting and human resource management, we added a central administrative personnel to manage the increased workload. The federal government provides reimbursement of direct costs associated with a substantial portion of personnel costs for this administrative staffing. This arrangement is a cost allocation plan referred to by the federal government as a centralized personnel plan. Centralized personnel plan assessments are budgeted as transfers from federal funded programs and provide reimbursement funding for the financial administrative division and the state personnel office employees not performing supervisory or information technology work. The federal government does not reimburse supplies and services, and we rely on general fund for material support in these two divisions. Other fund revenue.
Oh, yes, excuse me, sir. What would be some examples of supplies and services were not reimbursed?
Carl?
Madam Chair, the supplies and services, paper, pens, office machine rentals and leases, maintenance agreements. So the centralized personnel plan agreement we have with the federal government is just to recover a portion of our personnel costs, salaries and benefits only.
So the federal government, Carl, does not include office supplies as part of administrative costs?
Not under this arrangement, Madam Chair. And that this arrangement is made through the 53 entities throughout the National Guard, states and territories. And it's to help bolster the administrative staff to cover increased cooperative agreements that we won't have with the federal government.
Okay. And, Carl, would you have the amount that is not covered? Would it be possible for you to get that for us?
Madam Chair, I can get that for you.
Thank you. We'd appreciate it.
I've got it with me now.
Thank you. Any other questions? Okay. Please proceed, sir.
Other fund revenue is received primarily from the rental of facilities. Our armory other fund rental earning potential is in near jeopardy of being unable to adequately assist in funding our armories. Due to our heavy reliance on other fund revenues to operate our facilities, any reduction in other fund revenue directly corresponds to a further decline in facility condition, which in turn diminishes our ability to generate required revenue. We have the requirement to provide well-maintained facilities for our soldiers, civilian employees, and citizens and communities of Oregon, but our ability to generate other fund revenue is crippled due to the degradation and unsafe condition of many of our facilities. As previously mentioned, the installation status report document in our facilities report card to the National Guard Bureau and the Department of the Army. It reflects that Oregon facilities are generally less than adequate to perform the intended purposes. We are also experiencing a significant increase in armored usage by our soldiers. This is a direct result of the continuous mobilizations in support of national military strategy both in Iraq and Afghanistan. This situation is causing an increase in our operational expenses and reducing the available days of the facility for availability for rentals. In addition, we have experienced an increase in risk management claims that are a direct result of inadequate maintenance and repair funding. A recent analysis determined that 89% of our armories are not in compliance with Americans with Disabilities Act, the ADA. It is important that our armories meet these federal and state ADA laws, as over 30% of our armories is for rentals to the public and direct support of community economic development. These activities, such as trade shows, cultural events, and regional meetings, attract many visitors to the communities, bringing additional revenue to local businesses. Changes to land use zoning and the implementation of the new ordinances in numerous communities threaten and restrict the type and frequency of rental activities within many of our high-use armories. The environment I just discussed could significantly reduce our other funds earning potential in the upcoming biennium.
Carl, would it be possible for us to get a copy of that report on the condition of our facilities that the General just referred to?
Madam Chair, yes, and later on in the General's presentation, too, we'll show you an armory condition chart and where we're sitting. And if that answers your question, fine. If not, I can bring back more information.
Thank you very much. Please proceed.
Okay. Madam Chair, our Army National Guard facilities backlog maintenance and repair has increased to over $73 million from $60.5 million last biennium. At current funding levels, some armies will continue to have plumbing and electrical fixtures that are broken or inoperable, severely deteriorating parking lots, rotting wooden window frames, lead and asbestos-containing building material, and heating and cooling systems that do not work properly or provide adequate comfort levels. The 2005 to 2007 base budget does not provide adequate funding to address the minimum standards of physical security necessary to protect full-time employees, customers, community patrons of our facilities, drill status soldiers, or safeguard sensitive military equipment stored in our facilities. Also, the 2005-2007 base budget once again ignores significant structural seismic shortcomings in the National Guard facilities that are an integral part of our disaster planning in most of our Oregon communities. Our facilities must be capable of supporting local communities during floods, storms, fires, and other emergencies. Our reliance on other funds is a major budgetary source for making sure our facilities continue to be available during emergencies and by Oregon communities in support of local economic development activities. We have analyzed the use of our armories and determined that over 30% of the total use is by the public in direct support of community economic development. These activities, such as trade shows, cultural events, and regional meetings, attract many visitors to the communities, bringing additional revenue to local businesses. The Youth Challenge Program receives average daily membership other funds revenue through the Bend Lapine School District. The funds support a portion of the program's 40% state matching fund requirement. The Youth Challenge Program is one of our 16 state and federally cooperative agreements by which the federal government reimburses us up to 60% of the program's cost. The other funds balances for this program leverages the federal participation and absorbs initial costs pending federal reimbursements of 60%.
Carl, is this the reason I'm saying you instead of John Byrne, since this is your position? I didn't want to put him in an awkward position. But how long does our co-op agreement for our BEN program, our Youth Challenge program, how long does that last?
Madam Chair, the cooperative agreements are renewed every 4 years in our agreement between the Adjutant General and the United States Property and Physical Officer here in Oregon as a representative of the National Guard Bureau. So they run under a master cooperative agreement for our youth program, which includes the Starbase program for their air bases. And every 4 years we renew that agreement.
Carl, would you say we're in the first year of the four or the second or...
Madam Chair, we're starting the first year of a new four-year cycle.
Okay. It would be an injustice for that program to be turned down because of its outstanding success. It's just incredible. And would it be possible for us to contract for other programs like this? Can we have more than one since we're so successful and probably the premier school in the United States?
Madam Chair, I believe Colonel Caldwell can speak to that better. He attends national conferences concerning Youth Challenge Program.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Colonel Caldwell for the record. Right now there's presently 30 programs nationwide. Some states have more than one program. Louisiana has three, for example. However, the federal government only sponsors one of those programs. The state sponsors the other three 100% of the cost, the other two. To answer your question, I think it would be highly unlikely for us to be able to get additional federal revenues to support a second program. The reason I say that is the program nationwide has not had an increase in funding since 1994. And so what has occurred is the costs have been shifted to the state. You know, year in and year out, there's just a steady shift. Started out at 90-10, and now it's down to 60-40. And in Oregon, it's really closer to 50-50. We have been unable to match. We have not had the state funds to match the total 60-40. We have some higher costs for employees than other states do. The Guard Bureau does not factor in the condition that we're not paying minimum wage, and we're actually paying, you know, a living wage with benefits, and they bargain for that. So they don't pick up those costs. They run their model on a real low ball situation. So I think it would be very difficult to pick up enough money. And frankly, we can't even match the money we have right now. They offer more money than we can match. So we run a really, really tight-to-the-wire, low-ball program. There are no frills, absolutely none. We do the minimum. We're being constantly pinged by the federal government, by the National Guard Bureau, for not filling some positions we have open because we just simply can't afford them. We don't have a state match. However, having said all that doom and gloom, I will tell you this. We're still an excellent program, and for the first time since the program began in 1994, we were in the governor's recommended budget as it comes to this body. So that has not occurred in 10 years until this governor saw fit to do it. That's so we're very grateful for that.
Yes, it certainly is outstanding. Any other questions? Please proceed.
Oregon National Guard soldiers and airmen responding to state emergencies and called to duty by the governor are placed on state active duty and compensated as temporary state employees. Other funds balances are maintained to ensure we have a seamless mechanism in place for the call of our Guard members and their equipment to cover these associated costs. In 1996, the Oregon National Guard responded rapidly in providing assistance and relief during devastating floods. More than $500,000 in personnel and equipment costs were not reimbursed, and the agency's budget, other funds were required to cover these expenses. During the 1999-2001 biennium, the agency spent nearly $1.2 million on forest fire assistance and was not reimbursed by the Oregon Department of Forestry. During the 2001-2003 biennium, the agency spent over $5 million on forest fire assistance, and not all personnel expenses were reimbursed. During the fire suppression assistance provided in 2002, three soldiers were stationed with Oregon Emergency Management to assist in coordinating activities, and the $20,553 spent in unbudgeted personnel costs were absorbed by the agency at the direction of the Department of Administrative Services. In the summer of 2003, the Oregon Military Department mobilized helicopter and aviation support resources for the suppression of wildfires both here in Oregon and California. The agency costs associated with the summer of 2003 emergency support was over $128,000 and was fully reimbursed by the Oregon and California Departments of Forestry. Because these natural disasters and associated state active duty requirements cannot be foreseen, there is no base budget for the emergency operations and response. Instead, the Oregon Military Department requests other funds limitation at emergency boards after such operations occur. The Command Group Financial Administrative Division and the Personnel Office, as part of the administrative program, absorbs the increased workload, overtime, and or temporary hire assistance associated with the management and administrative support required during these emergency operations. Another funds balance requires to initially support mobilizations directed by the governor and other miscellaneous state active duty requirements pursuant to ORS 399.065 and 399.075. Maintaining the ability to immediately employ Oregon National Guard personnel and their equipment on state active duty status allows for the seamless activation and operation of the Emergency Operations Center and the coordination with other federal, state, and local agencies at the onset of emergency response. The money is needed and maintained up front, and there is no guarantee at all costs and expenses are completely reimbursed. In short, other funds balances generated through the sources I have described provide for contingency and emergency operations of the agency each biennium. This chart shows our budget structure. Our budget is organized into three major programs: the administrative program, operations program, and community support program. The emergency program assists the command group in management of the agency. The command group provides serious senior level leadership, administration, and management of the Oregon National Guard. The operations program includes all programs that support operations and maintenance of our facilities. It also includes the counter drug program, the Air National Guard administrative program, equipment refurbishment program, and telecommunications program. There are several major budgetary issues for the operations program that I will discuss in detail. The community support program includes two highly successful youth programs in our emergency operations program. The emergency operations program coordinates critical manpower and equipment support for emergencies in Oregon when called upon by the governor, the commander-in-chief of the Oregon National Guard. Responding to state emergencies is part of our core mission and places our soldiers and airmen on state active duty status when ordered by the governor. The Oregon Military Department and the Oregon National Guard experienced many changes and adaptations during the 1990s leading up to the 2005-2007 biennium. Since the 1991 legislative session, the department's general fund employees have been cut from a 20-year high of 101 employees to its current number of less than half of those employees, reliant on general fund supporting salaries and benefits. Generally, we have adapted by shifting duties to federal positions and leveraging state dollars better to fund positions through a mix of federal and state funds. This was accomplished during a time when other agencies grew while the military department suffered cuts in program support. This chart shows the 14 policy packages recommended in the governor's budget. We submitted 28 policy packages in our administrative request budget, and I'll show you these in our next slide. This chart shows the 15 policy packages we submitted to the agency request budget that are not recommended in the governor's recommended budget. A shortage of many types of National Guard facilities exists, but there is a crucial need for new armories and upkeep of our existing inventory. A large number of our armories were designed and built in the 1950s to support unit personnel and equipment requirements, approximately half of those today. These facilities have exceeded their design life and are increasingly expensive to maintain. Not only are major systems and components failing at alarming rate, but these facilities lack proper handicap accessibility and are riddled with asbestos, lead, and environmentally dangerous refrigerants that are expensive to maintain or replace. These facility issues pose a substantial revenue loss and property management risk. Due to a lack of adequate funding, we have been unable to properly address State Historical Preservation Office concerns in our older buildings, many dating back to 1911. Older facilities fail to address the needs of female soldiers and contain little or no space for women's restrooms. The older facilities also lack adequate infrastructure to support today's ever-increasing electrical and telecommunications requirements, demands. Currently, 64% of our armories do not meet National Guard Bureau standards, and another 21% only partially meet National Guard Bureau standards in terms of space and criteria. However, keep in mind that Congress must allocate funding, federal funds, for us to replace our armories. In the meantime, we must maintain what we have. This chart shows our capital improvement policy package, requested in the agency request budget, but not recommended in the governor's recommended budget. This chart shows funding for the five projects recommended for the next biennium in the governor's recommended budget. Our final chart shows ongoing capital projects that were approved in previous biennium. The Oregon National Guard is an organization of dedicated, loyal, and proud men and women. We serve our fellow citizens of the state of Oregon and the United States as a ready force, equipped and trained to respond to any emergency, contingency, natural, or man-made. When we are needed, we are there. And this concludes my testimony. Are there any questions?
Any questions? Representative Hunt?
Could you possibly go back two slides? Exactly. If I could ask, so when you are actually seeking the federal funds, do you actually just seek a general allocation and then look at all the condition of your facilities and allocate that? Or are you forced to go back and say, Camp Rylea needs XYZ, we want $1.5 million for that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hunt, actually it's a combination of both. If we break certain thresholds, with $750,000 capital? If you break $750,000 of capital expenditure for improvements, then we have to get National Guard approval. If you're under that, then you can spend, we have an allocation each year that comes in from the federal government, from National Guard Bureau, and we use that money for a lot of different things, everything from lights, heat at these camps. The big difference, I think, maybe for your edification, would be, one, that if it goes over $750,000, yes, we have to have approval, and we also have to have approval of this body in our budget. Secondly, I would tell you that even though we may have approval to do that, if the money does not show up because of budget cuts or some, you know, master plan at the National Guard Bureau, even though the project's worthy and we could do it, we don't have the money. So it's an art, certainly not a science, to try to, you know, balance that and figure out, you know, we got X amount of federal money coming in, we got approval from the legislature and state money to put with it, then we'll go out and do a project. If we don't, then we don't. We just put it on the backlog list and just keep tallying it up. If you look at these projects, all of these projects are, you can see infrastructure, fire suppression, training center. You'll notice all of them have federal funds except for the last item. And the last item is actually here at an armory. The others are at camps, which are generally 100% federally supported. Camp Rylea, for instance, has zero general fund dollars going toward it. They generate revenue by we lease a building, one of our barracks is to the Oregon State Police. They run their recruit school there. So we generate revenue from that. We lease out to sheriff's offices for use of our ranges and a whole host of different, I mean, you name it, we have people at Camp Rylea for one reason or another. And we generate revenue from that, and that becomes the state participation. The rest of it is 100% federal, and we can do that on a training site. We can't do that in an armory. On an armory, if we spend federal money on that armory, we have to match it 50-50 with state money. So what we've got is we've got a degradation, basically. If you go to Rylea and you look at the facilities at Rylea, you go, my, these are nice, they're wonderful, and they are. And then you go out to Lebanon or Dallas, you see a 1911 armory in Dallas, you see a 1945-47 armory in Lebanon, and you know, we try to keep them as best we can, has been explained, but they're certainly not at the degree that you would see at Camp Rylea. So that's why we have those haves and have-nots.
Thank you, Colonel Caldwell. Carl, the page that looks like this says capital improvements recommended. It's prior to this.
Yes, Madam Chair, it's up here.
Okay, is this 4.2 million, Carl? Do you see that I'm talking about the total? Is that in this year's budget?
Madam Chair, no. This is what we requested in the budget. What was recommended in the governor's budget is the top line.
The Central Oregon Readiness?
No, we're very top. Recommended zero.
Oh.
Oh, okay. Madam Chair, I have a question as well.
I have lots of questions, but we'll save those, I think, and have a specific hearing on facilities, if it's possible, later. But go ahead, Representative Farr.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question a few pages forward. Construction approved in previous biennia, and under general fund for the Ontario Readiness and the Dalles Readiness Center, you've got $1 allocated. Was that necessary? Did the state have to allocate at least $1 for you to receive the federal funds?
Madam Chair, Representative Farr, that's correct. We have to have approval from the state to even receive those funds. And so typically what happens in this process is that we will seek federal dollars, and we get into a queue, if you will, and they have what they call a future year defense plan. And we'll get in that queue, and that's usually a seven-year queue. And we submit projects based on that colored chart, shows the varying degrees of armory suitability. And if you go back and look at it, you'll see Ontario and the Dalles right at the bottom. And so we put them in that queue, and then we come to this body. And before we start asking for funds, we say, now, when we get here in this queue, we need money to build this because you got it 75-25, 25% state, 75% federal. So we don't want to wait 7 years, get in there, finally get funded, and then have legislature say, sorry, no money, because then we lose our spot, the money gets distributed to another state, we go back to the end of the line. So we try to bring it up as early as possible in the legislative process, let people, you know, let this body know that we are intending to do this, And there's no guarantees, as we all know, based on budgeting and based on resource allocation. But we don't want to surprise anyone, and we certainly don't want to spend that seven-year process of getting into this getting to this point, getting the design money from the feds, which they give us 100% of. And we do the design, and then we get to the day when they say, now you're appropriated, now you're authorized. And we say, sorry, no 25%. So that's why it's there that way.
Thank you.
Carl, back to the page previous to this that we were talking about, the one that's recommended where we saw the outstanding contribution of the state, which was zero. Are those federal funds available? If we matched, if we did our part here at the state, would you get the $1,890,000 if we did our part?
Madam Chair, yes, ma'am. We have, again, when I try to answer Representative Hunt's question, we get an allocation from the federal government. What we would do is we would shift money from 100% federal funded projects at the camps, and then we would put it into these armories if we had the state match. We've been able to do that through e-board requirements or requests based on when some of these things got so severe, particularly roofs. We had 10 armory roofs that were... We did a study. We were worried about it. We found some dry rot in a few of them. We hired an engineer. We went out and did some studies, and they came back far worse than we thought they were. And we came to the e-board. We said, we got a serious problem. These things are going to fall in. And we received, do you remember the amount, Dave, $1.5?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, $1.5 million from the emergency board, and we were able to move those federal funds over and do 50-50 projects as opposed to 100% state projects, which is good leverage on the dollars. That's what the chart represents, and that's what we would do if we had state revenues. We would move those federal dollars away from the camps and put them against those projects.
So, General Colonel Carl, would you say, are these the critical, I mean, however many there are, 10, critical 10 capital needs at this time out of all of these 30-something facilities? Are these the critical ones? Have you already gone through that? And are they prioritized the way they are listed here?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, that's correct. It's a prioritized project list. And those we'd start were our highest and biggest need and work down. And
so is the amount you would need from the general fund, I'm still thinking in the terms of the 25-75 match, and here we have general funds needed a 2.4 to add to this 1.8 of federal funds. It's not a 25-75 allocation.
Which one are you looking at, Madam Chair?
I was I'm probably confused. We want to work hard to get this cured for you, or I do. I shouldn't.
Madam Chair, and I stand corrected. This was what we submitted in the budget. That's 8 months old. We have a annual process that goes through it, and it has adjusted slightly. Dallas roof came up before the Hood River, for instance. So we've adjusted our priority list somewhat over that.
We could get an updated
copy. Yes, ma'am.
Copy.
That's what's in our budget.
Okay. This is in the budget.
That's in the budget.
But
that's what we requested.
Update.
We did not receive those funds. But again, we continue to go through and process this information as situations change. And, for instance, Dallas Roof was discovered to be
good management.
Well, we were required to do this to the Bureau, for the Bureau. They require this information at all times because they use the same information to go to Congress and say we need funding to maintain our facilities, so they use the same logic.
So, Carl, could you give us some footnote to the new priorities and let us know how much specifically we're going to get from federal and what the match is? If it's not 25-75, what is it? And then, since I have never met with the national organization, Do we get some kind of commitment? I mean, so, for example, if this committee, really got on a campaign to fund this in some way, we want to have some document that would speak to the fact that we do have the match, We just got to somehow get some money from the lottery or somewhere. Representative Collins.
Chairman Nelson, you answered most of my questions, which I appreciate, but I'm still confused on the capital improvement page and then the page that says construction approved in previous biennium. I'm confused at the ones that have already been approved. There's only one from the current list that says we need to have done. So my question was, are the ones on the previous construction that's already been approved or the agency request, which is the most important?
Madam Chair, Representative Comp, basically you have two. You have a division between capital improvement and capital construction.
Okay.
And that's a price tag issue.
Oh, this is construction.
Right.
Okay.
And so when you move past the 1.5 or 750,000 state.
750.
The 750.
Yeah. And we have and we have different rules. The feds actually have to call their capital improvement 1.5, I believe.
Okay.
And so it does get a little confusing, but for state terms, anything over $750,000 is capital construction. Anything below that is capital improvement. So they fall in different categories with respect to the budget. And when you look at the capital, these are the capital construction items. For instance, Lane County Armed Service or Armed Forces Center, $33 million federal funds, $5.39 million of state funds. And that project is underway as we speak.
Okay.
And it's in the process of being constructed. If you move down, Baker City Armory, Baker City Center 4 and 3, again, there's a that project is complete. I was over there 10 days ago. They're just finishing up a couple items. Brand new, beautiful building. The unit's presently in Iraq. So we've got one person in the building. So
that would be helpful to see what's ongoing, what's completed, and
right.
to do. Because that, if I may have a follow-up.
Yes.
Madam Chairman. Because my question, the follow-up was, do you have a 10-year strategic plan to basically, you know, so that you know, it's like me when I have a housekeeping list. This is what I got finished this today, you know, so that you can check off and acknowledge that we all can say, well, this is what's happening. And it's important for us to be able to acknowledge what's happening and what our needs are.
Well, thank you, Representative Kopp. I know what my problem is now. I don't have a house cleaning priority list, but I'm going to work on that this weekend.
Well, that's how I do it. You know, I make a list.
Just kidding. All right. Are there any other questions?
Madam Chair, just to answer that question, perhaps, and we do, again, it's 8 months ago we put this together, but we do have, and I'll pull this and extract it for you, in our capital. Capital construction request, we have that items. What we attempted to do here was to show you what was in progress.
Okay.
And
thank you.
And essentially, that's what you got. Is you got Baker and Eugene in progress. And the rest of those are. And I can give you a timeline. We have limitation expiration date on it. What I need to tell you is just exactly where the project is. So like Lane County's 10%.
Yeah.
You know, 15% right now.
Because it's what we're, I think what we're all kind of after is, you know, we want to improve the situation, and yet we need to know what we need to rally around, and so that we can find out what we can and can't do and what that bottom line is.
I certainly concur with Representative Comp, and knowing that we have in concrete the commitment from the federal government, I'm greatly concerned about the new federal budget and the fact that we might be planning right now on some of these dollars, and they may not be here. So we can, you know, really work hard here to do our part to find any nickels we can and turn them into, you know, $4 million.
Madam Chair.
Representative Park.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a suggestion. Would it be at all possible for you to create a spreadsheet that shows very clearly what is capital construction, what is improvements, refurbishments, what is funded and what isn't?
Madam Chair, Representative Farr, we can do that with no problem.
Yeah.
That'd be very helpful.
Yes, that would be it. Hey, any other questions? Representative Hunt?
All of these capital needs, I guess, bring a question to my mind, which may not be a question you want, but so feel free not to answer it today, but maybe come back at some other point. Just looking at the millions of dollars of capital needs, then I'm starting to look at what are going to be millions of dollars probably of needs around education, employment, healthcare, transportation, housing kind of benefits. I think it would be really helpful for us if you all, not necessarily today, but at some point, if we're starting to expend too much on the benefit side that you think actually should be invested somewhat on the capital improvement side, I guess I would hope that you'd feel free to tell us that, and vice versa, because frankly, there's going to be no way that there's going to be enough money to make all the capital improvements mm-hmm. that we need mm-hmm. and all the human investments in veterans and National Guard members that we need. And so there are going to have to be some choices made. And it's challenging, at least for me, sitting on this side of the table, to look at all these needs. No, we're not going to be able to meet them all, at least this biennium, and not want to raise expectations out there that we are going to meet them all.
Madam Chair, Representative Hunt, yeah, indeed, I think that is the challenge of this body in every aspect of what you're doing here this session. When we look at the realities of the limited dollars that are out there and the needs that are horrendous needs, and we're certainly no different than anybody else. And when you give us something came from somebody else. That's really generally the thought. We're very cognizant of that, you know, and I'll say again that this current governor's budget is certainly a whole lot better than anything we've experienced over the last decade, and he's recognized that, and we're very grateful for that. And we certainly don't want to sit here and give the impression that this thing has been inadequate. It's always inadequate. I think it's no matter how you look at it, and if you've got another department in here, whether it be Jim Willis, my friend Jim Willis behind me, he'd tell you the same thing probably for his department. We recognize these realities, and we're certainly trying our best to stay on the team and make sure that we pull on the same rope with our boss. We appreciate your interest in all of these particular issues, and they are significant. There's no question about that. But we're chipping away at it. We realize there's not, if you look at our list, there's $65, $70 million worth of backlog on it. Mm-hmm. You know what? If you gave us $65, $70 million of revenue to deal with that, we couldn't accomplish that in 3 years or 2 years. We don't have the staff. You know, we couldn't get it done. But we feel it's our obligation to let people know just exactly where we're at as well. And any chipping away that we can get at it, just we're grateful for that. So you're absolutely correct, and we will. We know that we're experiencing things today with our soldiers coming home from combat that we've never experienced before. And that is our highest priority. There's no question about that. If we're going to prioritize dollars, we're going to prioritize it on the people, not the buildings. At the same token, we got to keep a roof on these things. And that's really all we've been trying to do for the last decade, is just maintain the absolute minimums, because we didn't have the money then, and we didn't have the situation we have today with soldiers actually being deployed and coming home with other issues. So we're gonna focus on that first and always. And then we'll worry about the buildings, then we'll worry about the roofs, then we'll worry about asbestos, we'll worry about the lead, we'll do all those kind of things later. But frankly, we don't have a lot of our soldiers go up and chew on the lead paint, so we don't have a real risk in those things, and I think that's really what we're doing, is we're managing risk, and we're managing what risk we need to manage based on our current situation, whether it be budgetary and or deployments.
Carl, can we issue war bonds? Just anyway, in light of a... I am well. Why not consider it? Since we have a huge accounts receivable, could you? I think we should leverage it. So, could you possibly, for the last, I don't know how far we should go back. I'll just say 10 years. Go back to all of these disasters we responded to, all the firefighting, and I mean, let's really have a really clean accounting that nobody can compromise,
And let's see if we can't leverage that to get some of our needs covered so that we'll be here and properly trained in the facilities we need for the next disasters and emergencies. So I would very much appreciate getting that as soon as possible. I know of only one bill at this time that has been turned into Legislative Council on maintenance, and I don't believe we fully understood that there was this much to be done. I don't believe, but we could certainly change it. We have the right relating clause. So give us some leverage, and we'll certainly work with it.
Will do, Madam Chair.
And thank you very much. Any other questions? Thank you, Colonel Caldwell, and appreciate General Byrne. And Carl, certainly appreciate your being here.
Yeah, General Byrne had to be in Portland at in less than an hour, so he slipped out.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, we will now have a... ladies and gentlemen, we have a short presentation today. It's just a few minutes in duration. And prior to us getting, if it's okay, Director Willis, it's just a very short presentation, but it's very important. And since this meeting is broadcast broadly across the state, and as we found out last week, clear to Japan, I think it would be very good to give MJ and Clay Kesterson an opportunity to speak about the Afghan-Iraqi Memorial. So for that purpose, if we could just give them a few minutes, would you please come forward? And then we'll get right into the budget of the Veterans Administration, which is important to them, too.
Good morning, Madam Chair. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you so much for the opportunity of letting my husband, Clay Kesterson, and myself, MJ Kesterson, come and speak to you this morning on behalf of the Afghan-Iraqi Freedom War Memorial that we are presently working to build at the Capitol right here on the grounds. I'm going to stand for the purpose of showing off a rendering of the project and then maybe just give you a little background on it for those of you who haven't been able to hear a presentation on this subject before. So, 1 minute.
You need to hold that for you. Why don't I hold it?
There are a lot of faces in the room that I recognize, and I have done this presentation a few times, but I would like to start by saying that the memorial to my husband and I is a very dear and important project. Our motivator to remind some of you or to tell some of you that haven't heard our introduction to this project is that our son was a warrant officer, a Black Hawk pilot, who was killed in Mosul, Iraq, November 15, 2003. From that day forward, we made a commitment to ourselves, our family, our son, and to all the soldiers serving presently in the Afghan-Iraqi wars, that we would have a place of honor and dignity for the soldiers and their families presently serving and also deceased. With that being said, Clay and I were just recently in Roseburg to pay our respects to the Moore family. They lost their son, a young Marine, Lance Corporal James Lee Moore, and he was buried on his birthday last week. And this week, my husband and I will be attending another service for a wonderful father, 44-year-old Sergeant Mark C. Warren, who was presently serving and died in Baghdad, and he's serving alongside his son, Lieutenant Warren, as well. These young men and women, as Madam Chair spoke of earlier, are being deployed. We want them to know that there's a place of honor and respect, We want the families who are losing their sons to this war to realize that rather than waiting, we are going to do something about honoring that service immediately, right now. We've been very lucky. Jim Willis helped us quite a bit in getting this piece of land to put the memorial in place. And I'm just going to turn it around really quickly, maybe step over here, to tell you that we're looking at about a 500-square-foot project. And this is a walkway all the way around the monument. This will be a 6-foot pedestal of marble with all the service medallions represented. All the service medallions will be in place here on the marble. All the service people's names will go on to the marble base as well. This is a life-size soldier. He will be on a piece of marble that's actually going to move. It'll be driven by the shallow pool, and it'll allow him to extend his hand out over the land masses, which will then be carved out of or cut out of stainless steel, and it'll be raised about 2 feet out of the shallow pool. This monument's going into an area that already has monuments in place. Most recently, the Korean monument was dedicated, but there are Medal of Honor monuments there, World War I, World War II, and this monument will be center stage to the space between the Medal of Honor and the Korean monument. And we just want everybody and our voice to be heard through the entire state. This is a state project. It's true that it was driven initially by our loss, but it's recognized by the service and the sacrifice made by the families whose loved ones are serving throughout the entire state, the readiness for them to go. And a place of respect is needed now, again, not 50 years from now or 20 years from now. And we are fundraising. We go every weekend, we're somewhere. Last weekend we were in Grants Pass. This weekend we'll be in Pendleton. The weekend before we were in Roseburg. We intend to do it inch by inch till it's completely done. Any and all help would be, of course, welcomed. We're looking for volunteers. We're looking for sponsorships. We're looking for the person who wins the lottery and doesn't know what to do with the extra money. Although I can hear from the room today that we could probably put it in a lot of places. But I appreciate the opportunity to tell everybody about the project. If there's any questions, we'd be happy to answer them. And keep up the good work and pass on the word. We really need help. We would like to break ground November 15, by the way. This year coming up. That would be Eric's second year anniversary, and we needed to set a goal, and it feels like a good goal, and you know, there's a really good chance that we could do this by November 15th. We have about $155,000 now in in-kind donations, and we have $25,000 in cash. So my husband and I are committed to making this project come to be, and I think it's doable. You know, I think we could break ground. So, thank you.
Thank you, Clay and MJ Kesterson. MJ, is there a website that people could learn more about this?
We do have a website, and the website is freedomisn'tfreeoregon.org.
freedomisn'tfreeoregon.org is the web. And would there be an address or that they would send contributions to or offers to assist or volunteer?
For the record, our address is 763 Cessna Street.
763 Cessna is in the airplane?
As in the airplane.
Cessna Street.
Independence,
Oregon.
97351.
97351.
And our phone is also on our website, but I will give it for the record as well, 503.
The phone for the record is 503. 606
2765.
2765. Thank you so very much. Are there any questions? We appreciate your being here today.
Thank you. Thanks for the opportunity.
You can also make direct deposits to any Sterling Bank. They hold that account.
Okay, Clay Kesterson has told us we can make direct deposits at any Sterling branch.
That's right.
Sterling Bank branch directly to the African Iraqi Memorial.
Right.
In any location in the state.
That's correct. Thank you.
Thank you. We appreciate that. Okay, at this time I'd like to call on our Honorable Director of our Department of Veteran Affairs, Jim Willis, to come forward with his budget overview. And I would imagine, committee members, that we should probably be completed by 10:15.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jim Willis. I'm Director of the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. I'm joined here this morning on my immediate right by Mr. Bruce Schreiber, who is the Chief Financial Officer for the Department of Veterans Affairs, and on my far right by Mr. Randy Basil, who is the Department's Budget Officer. Our intent this morning is to give the committee an overview of the Department's budget for two previous biennia. This will be a high-level executive overview for you. Again, of the two previous biennia, the current biennia, and the projected biennia 05-07. So with that, I will turn it over to our financial folks, and they will run through a spreadsheet that has been given to the members of the committee, after which, of course, we will be happy to answer any of the committee's questions. Will that be acceptable, Madam Chair?
That is excellent, Director Willis.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bruce Shriver. As Mr. Willis said, I am the Chief Financial Officer of Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. I do want to make one confession here. I do tend to, at times, slip into acronyms, so I have prepaid.
Oh,
I have prepaid for four offenses, so
okay.
Let me know if I...
Prepayment, that's what I should start. New campaign.
If I exceed four, please let me know. But anyway, as you should have a one-page summary here. And what I thought I would do is give a high-level overview of the three primary programs that we offer services to veterans, and then talk about the budgetary trends that have occurred over the last two previous biennium to our current governor's request budget. The first primary program in which we offer services to Oregon veterans is the department's home loan program. This program has been around for many years, and in fact, since 1945, we've made over 333,000 home loans to Oregon's veterans. The mechanism by which we obtain funds to lend out to Oregon veterans is through the issuance of tax-exempt bonds. And again, since that 1945 date, we've issued in excess of $7.4 billion of bonds. The loan program does not use any general fund monies. It's entirely self-sustaining. It's all other funds. And the primary revenues of that program relate to loan repayments from veterans, investment income on those monies. And that those funds are then used to pay off the bonds that are issued. I should note on your sheet, or point out to you on your sheet, the figures for the loan program are only those figures that are limited. It does not include non-limited expenditures. And the non-limited expenditures are those for like paying the debt service on the bonds or paying property taxes for the veterans. And to give you a sense of the magnitude of those, for like the 05-07 governor's request, that the non-limited expenditure would be about $594 million. So you can see the operating portion is like 3% or less of the total.
So, Bruce, you would be comparing the 200, what was the number?
The non-limited figure, it's about $594 million.
Oh, the $594 million to the 16.7?
If you add the 16 to the 594, it's about around 3%.
And that's the portion from loans being paid off and investment income?
That 3% piece. The 3% piece, Madam Chair, the 3% piece has to do with funding the positions at the department that administer the loan program, payment of services and supplies.
So that's basically the overhead of that program?
Well, overhead and...
And operations.
And all just operations, yes.
Okay. Thank you.
The general trend on the loan program over the last several bienniums has been it's a shrinking program. And there's a couple reasons for that. Many loans were issued or made back in the late 70s, early 1980s, and many of those loans are just paying off, you know, regular amortization. People are paying those off. We also have been in recent years in a lower interest rate environment, so people have refinanced those loans, paid those off. We also have had some roadblocks at the federal level in that the vehicle by which we issue most of our bonds, they're called qualified veteran mortgage bonds, they have a restriction in the federal law that you had to have served prior to 1977 for you to get to be able to receive monies from our bondage, from that particular type of bond issue. So the pool of eligible veterans served by proceeds of qualified veteran mortgage bonds continues to shrink each year. Now, what Oregon has done the year 2000, they passed ballot measure 83, which allowed Oregon for us to serve veterans or make loans to veterans who served after 1976. We've been able to make loans to them from some very old monies that didn't have that tax restriction on those. So I hope I'm not confusing you, but there's two pots, but the federal restriction, the point I'm trying to make is the federal restriction on the types of bonds that we can issue and who we can serve with those has crimped our ability to serve Oregon veterans, and that has also led to the decline in the levels of the loan program. And probably the final piece is that we have partnered with mortgage brokers and financial institutions to also assist us and assist the veterans in the local communities to be able to make their to obtain a loan from them, and then we would purchase a loan from them. So that's not too verbose, but that is why the loan program has tended to shrink over the years.
Bruce, could you possibly tell us, is there a waiting list at this time of these younger people who haven't owned a home yet?
Madam Chair, there's not a waiting list per se. They can come in today. We have money. We still have some older money available for them.
And what is this interest rate?
The interest rates depend upon the points they opt to choose to put down. It's either 5 1/8 or 4.99%. And those rates will be, you know, they're periodically monitored and adjusted.
Okay, thank you.
Moving on to the Veterans Home Loan. I'm sorry, the Veterans Home Program. That's the second major program area. That what that program is that serves veterans in need of skilled nursing care. It's a facility that's located in the Dalles, Oregon. It opened late 1997. It's a 151-bed facility. consists of three 42-bed wings that provide general skilled nursing care. And then they have one wing, 25-bed wing, that deals with dementia and Alzheimer-related ailments for veterans. And also spouses can be placed in that facility. That program has been entirely funded by other funds to date. It has been in the earlier bienniums, the census has grown more slowly than was originally anticipated. It hovered sometime around 100 people, so maybe about 65% occupancy levels. Just in the last several months, that it is now between 80 and 85% occupancy level.
Bruce, out of $365,000 veterans in the state, where are the others? I mean, if this is this will accept a total of how many?
151 beds. And Madam Chair, from a practical standpoint, a couple of those would also probably be held vacant, you know, just to assist in, you know, transferring personal effects and things. So effectively maybe 149, 148.
So where are all these other disabled veterans who need care? I'm just basing that up on my private world.
Mm-hmm.
I'm basing it upon a town with a population of 25,000, and I know the tremendous need for beds in our care centers in my location. So I'm just wondering, where are all the other veterans getting this type of care?
Madam Chair, those veterans would be placed in a local skilled nursing facility.
Do all skilled nursing facilities accept the veterans benefit plan?
Most of those, Madam Chair, most of those would probably fall under Medicaid, and yes, they are able to enter the home via Medicaid, or also the federal VA does have some contracts with local skilled nursing facilities for the placement of some veterans too.
So does a facility have to have a contract with the federal VA in order to serve veterans, and this be charged against their VA program, not instead of Medicaid?
Madam Chair, they don't have to go through the federal VA.
Facilities don't?
Well, Madam Chair, the veteran, if I'm understanding your question, and correct me if I'm not, the veteran can just opt to, he or she could be a private pay at a local nursing facility, or they could just enter a local facility under Medicaid. I mean, I don't believe they have to get the permission of the federal VA to go to their local facility.
In order to access federal benefits, they don't?
Madam Chair, yeah, to access the federal benefits, yes, they would have to go through the federal VA.
And so, therefore, would we have a move in our state to get all care centers and foster homes accredited or certified or whatever we do by the federal VA so that our veterans can stay close to their home and use their own benefits that, you know, they're entitled to?
Madam Chair, yeah, I think, again, we would want to have the veterans coordinate with the federal VA to the extent possible. Yes, ma'am.
But the homes, I'm just trying to get the homes certified. So a person who lives in Dallas, Oregon, could go to the Dallas care home. Does that home have to be accredited or certified by the federal VA for this veteran to go there to use his veteran benefits.
Madam Chair, I believe that if for the record, my name's Randy Basil. I'm budget officer with the Department of Veterans Affairs. Madam Chair, a veteran could go in, and if the nursing home is willing to sign a contract with the federal VA and accept what they're going to pay, then it would be possible that they could stay in the local facility. I believe as long as DHS has approved them as a facility, that they're eligible to sign a contract with the federal VA, but it would be the facility's option whether they wanted to sign it or not.
Yes, Representative Farr.
How does the federal veterans benefit for that type of service compare to what they would receive if they took Medicaid from the state?
Madam Chair, Representative Farr, I don't know what the current rates are for the federal VA, but I do not believe they are as high as what Medicaid is. So that would be the driving factor of whether the facility would accept it or not.
Would it be possible to get that information?
Yes, I believe we can.
We would very much appreciate that. Any other questions? Okay, thank you, Bruce, for letting us ask. That's a very important issue to us. Thank you.
Very good question.
And are the other funds, what are they in this area of Veterans Home? Are these Medicaid monies?
Madam Chair, it's a variety. There are Medicaid monies in there. There are Medicare monies, and there are private pay monies. And we also get a per diem. The VA pays a per diem.
Who pays a per diem?
The federal, the United States Department of Veterans Affairs pays a per diem. I think I've already got over my four.
I'm trying to help you.
Thank you.
You take credit cards.
I might need to leave mine. But those are the primary revenue sources.
Okay. Is it possible to break down other funds in these three categories and let us know what percentage comes from various sources so that at least I am smarter than I
am? Madam Chair, we'd be happy to do that.
Thank you. Okay.
And budgetary trend on that one, just to conclude with the Veterans Home, budgetary trends, the expenditures are tending to rise. Mm-hmm. Two factors again, increased occupancy levels and the higher cost of providing care for our veterans.
Well, could Bruce, how come I don't see any numbers in there?
It might be a bit confusing. Over on the far right columns is we put in what we know today. We know the governor's recommended line items, but like we do not know what the legislative adopted budget line item will be, so that's why it's blank.
Well, how would we know what to push for if you don't put a number in there?
Well, Madam Chair, we're here to support the governor's recommended budget.
Well, I'm going to ask you to fill in the blanks, please, regardless of what the governor's budget says, and do so, you know, in the most prudent way possible. But please let us know what should be in those categories, because all we have is, you know, what we budgeted back in 2001 and mm-hmm. prior to this, and there's something haywire with these numbers when we see the huge increases that are being asked for by other divisions of the state. It's almost like, well, rising costs happen to everybody else but the Department of Veteran Affairs. So I would just like to know it, even if it's not in the governor's budget.
Okay. Madam Chair, so is this, just to make sure I'm clear, is this for like the agency recommended budget?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Okay. The budget request figures that you sent in initially, please. It's much like what we ask of the military, because we really don't know their repair program, and they have numbers in there, but we're not sure what they are.
Madam Chair, we do have some agency request figures here for you.
Thank you.
That would help. For the 05-07 budgetary period, up to the loan program, moving back up to the loan program
okay.
level, there was an other funds request of $17,168,000 and $17,168,125, zero for general fund, and so that the $17,168 would also be the total funds.
Okay.
For the Veterans Home Program
mm-hmm.
for the 2005-2007 biennial period, there was a general fund request of $240,000. Another funds request of $19,424,722 for a total of
$19,664,722.
Madam Chair. Yes.
Representative Hunt. On those two, I understand the $240,000 agency mm-hmm. request that was not included in the governor's budget. But for the other funds, help me understand how in one case the agency request was higher mm-hmm. than the governor's budget, the other case it was lower than the governor's budget. Why would, I mean, I assume the governor's budget would want to maximize access to federal funds or
yes.
other funds, and so would the agency. So why the discrepancy between the two?
The Madam Chair, Representative Hunt, the for the Veterans Home, that $240,000 request for general funds, since it was not included in the was not accepted, it was just added to the agency request. So that's how come it jumps up for other funds up to $19,664. It was shifted from a general fund to another fund.
So if I can follow up, Madam Chair, how do you anticipate where would those additional other funds come from if they're not coming from the general fund?
They would need to come from the revenues of the Veterans Home. Or there's also some possibly some trust fund monies that could be utilized for maintenance. This was primarily for maintenance items for the facility.
Madam Chair, Representative Hunt, what it was, it took into account the increase to the veteran in the bed, and if we were able to obtain general funds, it would be a less of an increase in their cost to maintain the bed.
So, Madam Chair, if I can follow up one more time on that one. Madam Chair. Can I follow up one more time on that?
Yeah, oh, sorry. I'm concerned about these numbers down here at the end. Go ahead, Representative Hunt. I apologize.
Thank you. No problem. So does that mean, in addition to all the Medicaid dollars that come in, the other the FTE that you mentioned, or the per diem that they receive, is there an actual rent, for lack of a better term, that is charged, an actual monthly charge to the veteran that varies up and down based on what the state funding for the home is?
Madam Chair, Representative Hunt, we actually have, it's a mix in the home. There's like 30% Medicaid patients. There's 70% private pay.
Okay.
It would be
okay.
an increase to the private pays.
Gotcha.
Why, Randy, would there be any Medicaid people in there? I'm assuming, certainly, that our Veterans Home is certified by our federal VA.
Madam Chair, the certification for the patients. That has to do with that per diem that they pay per day. And if the patient doesn't have the means to get into the thing and into the facility and they qualify for Medicaid, that is basically what has increased our census in the home, is by being Medicaid certified.
But why would these veterans not qualify for their own home?
In an Oregon veterans home, they do not pay an amount like they would to a private facility somewhere else located in the state, the VA.
So our own veterans from our state are not even qualified for our own veterans home.
Well, they qualify for the home by being a veteran, but they wouldn't be able to pay. There isn't a nursing home per diem to put them in the home. There's just the $60 a day, basically, that the USDVA pays for each day that a veteran's in a facility. They either have to make up the difference with private funds, or, which is usually covered by the comp and pen, which is approximately $1,400 a month, and Social Security, if they're receiving Social Security.
Madam Chair.
Representative Farr.
May I ask a question to see if we can clarify this?
Please.
So just let me go back to what you said. Is the veterans' benefit then combined, because it's so low, is it combined then with the state Medicaid benefit? Is that how you're arriving at this per diem figure?
Madam Chair, Representative Farr, the per diem figure is based solely on a veteran being in the bed, not the funding source of how they're being paid, whether they're private, Medicaid. There are some adjustments that are made if they're Medicaid.
So per diem is what it costs to keep that veteran in the home.
That's what's provided by the federal government.
Okay. All right, follow up.
It's a grant program.
All right, I'm sorry. I may be even more confused, and I hope I haven't confused everyone else. What I'm trying to understand is, in a veteran's home, is the veteran that's living in that home, are his expenses paid solely by the federal VA benefit, or is it a combination of that benefit and the state Medicaid benefit?
Chair Nelson, Representative Farr, it's a combination.
Okay. And what is the, what did you say per day the federal veterans benefit is?
It's somewhere around $60. It's like $50.
Madam Chair, Representative Farr, it's $59.36 per patient, per veteran, per day.
And then I might also say, if you don't mind, Madam Chair, please indulge
me. Please go ahead.
You used an
I'm happy to.
You used an acronym that I did not understand, and was that referring to the balance owing after the $60 was paid?
Compensation.
And pension.
That's Madam Chair, Representative Farr, that's for a low-income person. They may qualify for that from the federal government.
Would it be possible, Director Willis and Randy and Bruce, we're kind of going through some type of schizophrenia on this committee, because we find it very difficult to understand this situation. And you were great to give us a book on federal benefits. Well, you know, unfortunately, there's thousands of pages, and we're pretty bright, but not bright enough, I guess. And so would it be possible if we could please schedule a time to have laid out for us federal benefits, how they pay, Medicaid benefits, how they pay, you know, Social Security, Medicare, so that we could look at it. We previously had another meeting where we were told that we have very good veteran benefits, that they can all be totally covered if this committee would sponsor some type of event to bring this training program to all our county service officers. Well, we want to do that if it is the case, but right now I think some of us think this is nebulous. So rather than belabor this, would that be possible?
Chair Nelson, members of the committee, let me tell you that when I came to this role in state government, I was challenged exactly the same way.
Oh, good.
So let me tell you how it was solved for me, and if this will work for the committee, we'll provide it to you.
Great.
Because we treat every veteran, whether they're in the veteran's home or it's an educational benefit or it's claims for compensation or disability, one at a time. We don't batch veterans. We treat them one at a time. All right. That means that in the veteran's home, depending on means and income and disability, each of these people have a different veteran's home profile. And that profile is defined by these factors. So, when we talk about a Medicaid veteran in the home, that's funded in one way. When we talk about compensation, pension, aid, and attendance, and that kind of income, it's another way. And then when we talk about per diem, we have to understand that that's not paid to the individual, it's paid to the institution because of the population. So, what I would propose to do, Madam Chair, with your permission, is to supply yourself and the members of the committee and the administrator with a copy of a document that profiles what the residents in our home would look like depending on the various funding streams that are available. So you'd get an idea if that would work.
That would work. And can these individuals go to Roseburg or further south care homes under the same auspice?
The answer to that question is some can.
Okay.
But not all.
All right,
okay.
I promise. I'm not going there. Okay.
This is a very, very challenging system we have.
We'll just wait for clarity.
Yeah.
And maybe Representative Comp, being a school principal, could get us through it.
I don't know. This is worse than middle school.
We may have to send back.
Maybe. This is worse than school budgets.
Yes, this is worse than school budgets.
Yes, would you finish these numbers here, please, for us, Bruce, that you were working on?
Yes,
we were the Veterans Services. If you just give us that much.
Okay, yes, Madam Chair.
Please.
I think I was just finishing up on the Veterans Home. And again, those expenditure trends have been rising. I'll leave that one as is.
Okay.
The last primary program area in which services are rendered by the department is the Veterans Services area. And that includes several different activities in those numbers. Within those numbers, there's a claims and counseling section that counsels veterans, helps them prepare claims, can represent them as a power of attorney, works with them on appeals. So the intent there is to try to get them into or qualify for their federal benefits or into the health care system of the United States Department of Veterans Affairs. That's one series of
Do we provide
activities.
Legal services for them?
Madam Chair, I do not believe we do. No, ma'am.
So an individual like one whom I met on Saturday when I was with three different groups who went to a local hospital for an emergency heart operation and was charged $18,000, he thought the federal government, you know, in emergencies would cover, which they didn't, and these husband and wife had to pay this $18,000. Would we take that on under that category? And find out why the federal government didn't do what it promised veterans to begin with. It's in the law. that they have the right to access emergency care, and the federal government will pay their costs. Would that be where that would be?
Well, Madam Chair, that expenditure, that if I'm understanding, that expenditure would not be in there in these figures.
But would you help them under those services right there to secure that $18,000?
Good. We have. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jim Willis, Director of the Department of Veterans Affairs. This kind of thing, as described by Chair Nelson, has occurred in the past. Unfortunately, I believe it will continue to occur in the future. We have had people come to our service officers and to service officers at the National Service Organization level and at the county level who have been able to bring that to the attention of the United States Department of Veterans Affairs. Some of those on appeal have been successful, some have not.
Thank you. All right, for your final numbers, I'll allow you to give us the final numbers on the Veterans Services.
Oh.
Please.
Okay, Madam Chair. The second major area within a series of activities within the Veterans Services side deals with conservatorship services. What that involves is helping veterans or spouses or some of their survivors manage their financial affairs when they're deemed incapable of doing so. These are court appointments. Currently serve about 220 or so of these cases. And generally these are cases where no one is willing or able to serve this particular veteran or spouse or survivor. And finally, the other major areas within Veterans Services has to do with special payments. It deals with the aid to counties, aid to vet organizations, and also some rather modest educational aid benefits.
Is this the money for the county service officers?
That is correct, Madam Chair. That is correct. So those are the primary activities served within the Veterans Services side. As you look at the budgetary trends over time, that one's pretty flat. You know, it might be a little blip here and there, but it tends to be fairly flat. Now, if you look at the 2005-2007 figure, you're going to see where that shows a figure of about $4 million total funds. But what that is, it's moving some expenditures that used to be shown in the loan program down into the Veterans Services program. The Veterans Loan Program in the previous biennium had really provided financial support and funded some of the positions that were actually in doing Veterans Services activities. But in the 05-07 budget, it has been shifted from the loan program down to the Veterans Services program area.
So what are those numbers that were in your budget request?
Our budget request for 2005-2007 under Veterans Services, total general funds was $5,107,752. The other funds was $748,059 for a total request of $5,855,811.
Thank you. Are there any questions? If not, I guess we want to thank you, gentlemen, at this time and reserve the right to bring you back. If that's okay.
We would be happy to, Madam Chair.
And thank you so very much. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee.
Thanks. Okay. At this time, I would like to reopen the here.
You don't have
it. We don't have it. Sorry.
Oh, never mind. That's fine.
I take that back.
Did I exceed four fences?
You want to go get Betty Comp?
No.
I'm thinking that you're not revoting your state.
Okay. We will open that hearing and just the work session, I mean, on House Bill 2133.
Yes.
In order to give Representative Hunt an opportunity to add his vote to that bill in that work session. How do you vote, Representative Hunt?
Aye.
Representative Hunt votes aye on House Bill 2133.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Session is closed. I will now open a work session on House Bill 2192. And Representative Hunt, how will you vote?
We just voted on the amendment on that one.
Right. We amended that motion to be 2 years instead of one. Would you vote? Representative Hunt votes aye on the amendment. Thank you, and the work session is closed. And with that, we will close this committee meeting for today. Thank you very much.